This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm here today talking with Paul Messersmith Glavin about the politics and idea of degrowth communism. Thanks for coming on the Old Mole, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
So Paul is a Portland local, does radical acupuncture, is an anarchist scholar and contributor to different publications, is one of the founders of the Institute for Anarchist Studies, and contributes to their periodical Perspectives on Anarchist Theory. It's got a review coming out in the summer edition of New Politics. He's going to be reviewing a book that was published a couple years ago by Japanese Marxist scholar Kohei Sato called Marx and the Anthropocene. It is part of a number of books that Kohei Sato has written about Karl Marx and his explorations of ecology and communes and non-capitalist peoples. Paul, how did you get into learning about degrowth and what have you learned along the way?
In 2007, 2008, I spent a year in China, and China is an ecological disaster. I got very depressed there because you can't really see the sky, you can't see the sun. The part of China we were in Sichuan province, in Chengdu, is very smoggy. The environment there doesn't allow for the smog to dissipate, and really I took that kind of smog into my lungs and it turned into grief and became very depressed. I'm thinking that I was experiencing the future of life on this planet. And I couldn't even believe that China, this environment, existed on the same planet as Portland, Oregon. Because back in that time, Portland summers were beautiful, you know, crisp, clean, 70, 80 degrees after July 4th. And it's changed recently due to climate change. But at the time, it was a real contrast. And so coming back to the United States, my partner and I formed a study group to look into the causes of climate change and to try to get an intellectual handle on this phenomena that we had experienced in China, this ecological disaster area. And we spent a lot of time looking into the causes of the changing climate and what we could do about it, and got a handle on the economic foundations of capitalism in terms of how it's changing the climate, and began speaking to other organizers about how the changing climate will influence their work. And then most recently, I began participating in a Walter Benjamin study group where we read the theses on the concept of history.
Walter Benjamin, if folks didn't know, was an early 20th century Jewish mystic and Marxist and anti-fascist scholar and theoretician who wrote influentially about the themes of history and violence and revolutionary agency.
And so reading Benjamin was really great. And I knew about Sato's work on degrowth communism and his exploration into the later Marx. And for a long time, I had it in my head to do something looking at Walter Benjamin and Sato's work and the implications of that for ecological organizing and class-based organizing and transforming society.
Yeah, I've covered degrowth on the Old Mole a couple of years ago, and it has definitely gained even more steam than it had at that time. But I think that it's worth kind of reviewing some of these terms that have come out in the conversation so far, because, you know, every movement in every generation is in some way kind of reinventing its way of talking about the world as the world changes, but it inherits the terms and the situations those terms came out of from the past. So I just want to talk a bit about like what degrowth even means, how it is related to the obvious corollary concept of growth, and you know what some of the struggles around using this language have been. So when we talk about or hear people talk about degrowth, what are they really talking about?
But talking about interrupting the process of capital accumulation. So in my mind, I equate growth, economic growth, with the accumulation of capital. I know that that's a very specific definition, that there's other ways of defining growth. Some people include like job creation or increasing wages as part of the growth process. But for me, at essence, growth is about the accumulation of capital, which is accumulated off the backs of working people. So people that work are creating wealth, and that wealth is then stolen by the capitalists. And that's a process of economic growth. Mm-hmm. Part of it is interrupting that process of exploitation of labor and producing for exchange as opposed to producing for need.
Well, I mean, a lot of what we're talking about and looking at when we consider degrowth has to do with the material world, with the way that we actually live in it, the way that we take from or use the material resources of it and interact with the material living systems of the Earth. And when we are talking about capital accumulation, there's, you know, this abstract side to it, but then there's this very real concrete side, which is that materials are transformed to be sold on markets, to be utilized in exchanges. And that process of feeding the exchange itself is where we run into so many just completely bonkers problems when it comes to the exhaustion of what the bountiful Earth actually has. Because we aren't talking about producing for just use by humans, by people. We're talking about producing for the sake of making these exchanges happen. And being able to tease those apart is necessary to understand like what it is we want to degrow and what it means for the environment to interrupt these processes. Because when we talk about using the Earth to survive, to thrive, it's very different than using it to make money.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Marx in Capital talks about the original sources of all wealth being the soil and the worker. So for degrowth communism and Sato's work, basically you're interrupting the exploitation of labor and the exploitation of nature and creating a society that does neither.
You mentioned John Bellamy Foster kind of pioneering metabolic rift as a way of kind of talking about the environmental impact of capitalism and of the economy. What is meant by metabolic and what is meant by rift in that idea?
Yeah, that's a good question. For Marx, what it means to be human is to transform nature through labor. So we make things and change things and use nature in a way that we produce different things, right? And so the interaction of humans and nature is essential to human identity, what it means to be human. And the labor process itself is essential to what it means to be human. Under capitalism, that process is alienated. So workers create things which are then taken from them, commodities, and sold on the market, and they are not paid the full amount of the value of that commodity that's sold on the market. Hence, the capitalists make a profit off the labor of workers. Marx uses this metaphor of metabolism in Capital that talks about this human interaction with nature, this metabolism. He uses this metaphor of metabolism. So when that is a healthy relationship, when you're working with nature in a way that's not exploitative, then that's a healthy metabolism. But a rift occurs when capitalism basically exploits human labor and treats nature as both a resource and a place to dump waste. So there's this unhealthy relationship between humans and nature. There's a metabolic rift as opposed to a healthy metabolism.
In Marx's later studies into ecology and into agroecology and the biology or chemistry of soil health, you know, he recognizes how the way that agriculture had been developed in the industrial period near cities was changing the way that the soil actually was able to support any life on it. Nutrients in the soil are a finite thing. They need to be replenished. And this disruption of what is a cycle of resources that don't travel very far, they don't travel naturally for the reasons that they travel for markets, which take things from all over the world, mm-hmm. and capital has been global for hundreds of years now. And the you know, early development of chemical fertilizers was exploiting lands thousands of miles away from the European countries that were investing in the extractive labor to take those nutrients from other parts of the world.
Yeah, and that's how capitalism contributes to the changing climate, right? So you're producing commodities for exchange that people don't necessarily need. It's not, you're not meeting human needs, you're creating wants through advertising and then producing commodities which are packaged in all this crap that then is thrown away and goes into landfills. And the stuff is produced on the other side of the planet, exploiting human labor in various countries in this global south, and then transported via fossil fuel burning ships and planes and trucks and trains and everything to get over on the other side of the world to be sold to people that don't need these things. They're not fulfilling fundamental needs necessarily.
Yeah, it extends into, you know, things that are so structural and basic to how most people live that they have a hard time seeing them as even possibly optional. And the big outlier on this is cars, motor culture, and the way that it's transformed human society, the landscape. Climate change is driven by motor culture, but it's also driven by the energy demand of moving these resources across these vast distances for the sake of satisfying markets, not for the sake of satisfying human needs or human needs that can't be satisfied differently if less profitably. I think that we want to kind of recognize that it's not just a matter of letting go of superficial desires that are put into us by advertisements. We can't get away from how these lifestyles, if we're going to even call them that, are imposed on us. They're more of a kind of political regime that make us into willing subjects that do work for capital.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, for decades now, scientists have been saying we have to stop extracting and burning fossil fuels, right? And the capitalists in charge of things, the ruling class, have been ignoring that. But that demand and that scientific need for us to stop changing the climate in order for humanity to survive by stopping the extraction and burning of fossil fuels resonates with Walter Benjamin's idea of activating the emergency brake, which in turn resonates with the notion of a degrowth communism. It's stopping what we're doing that's going to endanger the future of humanity by continuing to burn fossil fuels and do all these other things that we're doing based upon that process. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of Marxists today still argue for economic growth and productivism, productionism, in particular Jacobin Magazine, which in the spring issue was all glorifying progress and growth and all these things.
Private jets for everyone.
Private jets for everyone, which is just such, I mean, like, these people, I don't know what they're thinking. Like, the ecological insustainability of their program is just, it should be obvious.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Paul Messersmith Glavin about the politics of degrowth in the work of Kohei Sato, a Marxist scholar from Japan, as well as other Marxists in recent years who have made this turn towards ecological analysis. Degrowth isn't just a Marxist movement. It isn't just a Marxist analysis. What are some of the other, like, dimensions to the way this movement has grown up? What other sort of intersecting concerns or movements are part of what we mean by degrowth?
Yeah, I think if the degrowth movement is going to be serious, it has to take capitalism seriously. And the person that took capitalism the most seriously was Karl Marx. So it's important to, like, read Marx and understand capitalism and understand how it's capitalism is the essential driving force behind not only climate change, but the broader ecological crisis we find ourselves in, and also human misery writ large. What Marx came to was very, in the last years of his life, was looking at non-capitalist peoples, looking at the natural sciences, and basically expanding his consciousness about what it means to be human, right? And indigenous peoples, you know, for millennia have lived in a way that is much more sustainable and ecological, basically in a no-growth fashion. Indigenous populations in what's now called North America did not necessarily exploit human labor for the profit of an elite few. Some tribes and nations may have. David Graeber and David Wengrow do a good job of looking at the nature and the diversity of native populations and various forms of social organization. But native peoples generally show an example of how to live in harmony with nature and how to live cooperatively amongst other human beings, which is what the goal of degrowth communism is. You know, feminists have looked at the role of reproductive labor and care and things like that and critiqued society in terms of its patriarchal values and structures and social relationships, and we can learn much from feminism. So indigenous and feminist ideas are both, you know, very important, as well as anarchism. You know, I'm an anarchist, I'm not a Marxist, but I enjoy reading Marx, and I think it's important to read Marx. But anarchism and the history of anarchism is a history of developing cooperative forms of organization, collectives and co-ops and things like that, and reorganizing society in a cooperative fashion, which is also another dimension of what any kind of degrowth communist society would look like.
Yeah, because, I mean, degrowth gets at this question of power in a way that we aren't often asked to think about. The way in which the built environment, the way in which our life ways are what drive, you know, our activity, our actions, and those who control those factors in our lives really have power over all of us. And trying to wrest that power from capital looks like making things that are available accessible and making it possible for people to enjoy utilities like movement in a communal way on our buses and trains. And the way that degrowth is drawing us to look at how power is constituted in society looks like these local projects that happen in your neighborhood or even in your building, but they also look like these large projects of what we should call society, where we are trying to coordinate our capacities and resources for everyone to shake the power of the ruling class, that they have this power over us because they control how we live. And being able to name what's problematic or constraining about the way we live is an important first step to kind of zeroing in on what we really need to change.
Yeah, I mean, like right now, you look at the grassroots community resistance to ICE raids, and that's an example of the kind of direction that society needs to go in, is that kind of like collective mass-based resistance to authoritarianism and proto-fascism. So that gives me hope, certainly. And that's an example of the kind of direct action that people can take in their communities to defend their neighbors and their family members and their co-workers. And the way that, like, these apps are spreading and to identify ICE in the neighborhood and things like that, and the way people are rising up in Los Angeles and resisting these things is all a reason for hope, right? And points in the direction that society needs to go. And it points to a different, fundamentally different society, a society based on cooperation and love and care, which is the exact opposite of the kind of structures that are being reinforced and militarized right now in the United States.
Degrowth contributes to that when we think of how initiatives like the Buy Nothing groups put people into relationships with each other, have them interacting in a way that makes it familiar to reach out to those who you know and those who you don't know to get help, and be familiar with what it feels like to have something to offer. And that kind of pre-political organizing is what we need to always be doing in order to have the muscles, in order to, you know, go after kind of more ambitious goals, like the overthrow of capitalism.
Yeah, I mean, during the pandemic, there was a proliferation of mutual aid projects, neighbors taking care of neighbors, and people in various workplaces and communities taking care of each other. And that was all over, like, Brooklyn, for instance. And the New Yorker wrote a whole article about the proliferation of mutual aid projects. And that's an example of people cooperating and taking care of each other. And that has to be generalized throughout society. And so it's kind of like both the Wobblies' idea of creating the new society in the shell of the old. We need to create what we're going to replace capitalism with, right, from the bottom up. But we also need to basically take all the wealth that's been created by the working class historically and give it back to the people that created that wealth, which is everyday working people. From each according to their ability, to each according to their need, based on that principle. So when people like criticize degrowth as being like advocating for people living more poorly or like generalizing poverty or things like that, I think that's a bogus argument. There's more wealth than we possibly need if it just has to be distributed equally throughout society. There's also the communal wealth that Marx talks about. There's the everyday wealth that we have of community gardens and things like that, the sharing that we have on an everyday level. But there's also a lot of wealth that needs to be expropriated, which is the revolutionary element. It's not just lifestyle change. It means we need a revolutionary movement to seize the means of production and transform those means of production and also expropriate the wealth that's been stolen from the working class and given back to people that produced it.
Yeah, and you know there are examples of working class movements that have sought to kind of like do something different with that power that they were seizing. A good example is the Lucas Plan. The workers in this aerospace company were getting sick and tired of producing for war and instead saw their technical capacities as still being valuable, but designing things like buses and other things of peaceful use that people need or would benefit from. That needs to come more into the conversation about what's the point of forming a union. Is it to just, you know, get your cut of the flow of capital that your labor enables, or is it to interrupt that flow and do something with it that changes that whole scenario? You know, degrowth is not anti-technology. It is, if anything, in a lot of ways, high technology with a kind of different perspective on how it's actually implemented or used. But there's also just the kind of material question of, for example, we need plastics for medical resources. Like, there are legitimate and widely felt need for plastic. We're wasting the capacity of the earth to produce and or sustain the presence of plastics on garbage. Mm-hmm. And degrowth looks like redistributing that capacity and those resources so that if we have to use something that's potentially toxic or has these environmental implications, that it's used for only the things that really benefit humanity and in proportion to that need, and not, say, the need for a company to increase its sales.
Yeah, not to mention like microplastics invading our internal organs and our brains and the oceans. And it's like every time I take out the garbage, I'm just like, where does all this go? And like, why does everything have to come in so much packaging? And, you know, what kind of society is this that's just like producing all this crap, endangering the future of humanity in the process?
Degrowth also fits in with a human need to take care of things. And part of that looks like how humans care for each other. But the idea of care, especially if we like want to borrow from different indigenous perspectives on like our relationship with the world as a living whole of some sort, that how we care for the built environment, how we care for the things that we take the trouble of hewing from nature to make, is also part of that ethos, that we make things to last, we make them to be repairable, we repair them, we use them in a way that does not act like it's okay to just throw them away when they break down.
Yes, right, exactly. When I was in college, there was this guy that lived in town who basically sold like 3-speed bikes and like taught people how to fix them. And people like all over campus rode these bicycles that were easy to maintain and got you around. And this was like his life work, you know, and that's like being a craftsman, you know, a craftsperson, like doing things that are sustainable, that help people, that provide a quality of life that's better.
I mean, I like you hitting on the idea of making life easier. That that is explicitly like part of the core platform that the Democratic Socialist running for mayor in New York, Zoran Mondani, has like put front and center for consideration, that Zoran will cut costs and make life easier. And there's really a lot more to it, but there also doesn't need to be a lot more to it as far as getting started with the idea of, like, what are we really talking about when we talk about degrowth? We're talking about cutting out the crap and making life easier.
Yeah, and we're talking about creating an abundance, not the Democratic Party notion of abundance that Ezra Klein and other holes in the Democratic Party are putting forward, but genuine abundance and sharing and cooperation and increasing the quality of life as opposed to the quantity of life. As opposed to the number of things that you can buy. It's like, how many needs are being met and how creative are you able to be and how much love do you have in your life and cooperation and friends and, you know, all that kind of stuff. This That's what we're talking about. And the left needs to start talking in a way that's attractive. The social movements of the 1960s, that's where everyone wanted to be. It was a welcoming, joyous place. And that's where everything was. And the left is no longer that. It's the opposite of that. And the right is where people want to be, because the right is writing a story that gives people a sense of meaning and belonging in a time of crisis.
Well, this is definitely a conversation that I think bears going on another time. I'd like to have you back on the Old Mole this summer, and we can dive a bit more into, you know, what it means to degrow the economy and change society, and look at the appealing possibilities, and not just ask these theoretical questions, but look more closely at, like, what is being done and what could we be doing next.
Yeah, I'd love to come back.
Well, this has been Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Paul Messersmith-Glavin about Kohei Sato's work on degrowth, on the broader movement organized around this idea of degrowth, and the really meaty questions of, like, what does it mean to change society?
Thank you, Joe. I really appreciate it.
Wake up, fellow workers. Why do you sleep so sound? The whole revenue that bosses keep taking is gonna burn this whole world down. Go away, fellow workers. Go away, that we need to win. Pretty contracts keep me distracted, and labor laws leaving me for dead. Get along, fellow workers. Get along, you and history. The struggle we're in is a long one, spanning more than a century. In the day when we withheld the labor, workers had the power to win. Slowdowns and sit-ins persisted, and union power feared boss men. Take your time, fellow workers. Take your time on a long working day. Take your time from them bosses. Take control of your labor today. It's your time, fellow workers. It's your time to save the day. It's your time, not them bosses. Don't let them waste it until it's too late. Pull the brake, fellow workers. Put a stop to this runaway train. If we don't, then it's all gonna crash on a slow burning doomsday. Organize, fellow workers. Take control of your own workplace. If we don't, the bosses off our backs, then we'll enjoy living at our own damn pace.
The music you just heard was composed and performed by our own Joe Clement. Before that, Joe was speaking with Paul Messersmith-Glavin about degrowth.